WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth, and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Groundhog Day continues in the USA. In the weeks that have passed since our last show, COVID-19 continues to kill about 1,000 Americans each day. And another unarmed black man was killed by police, Jacob Blake. He was shot in the back 7 times as he got into his car with his kids inside. And the impacts of climate change continue to manifest in ways that we're watching on the news. All of the events that I'm about to mention took place in the few short weeks since our last show. This hurricane season is on pace to break the record for the most named storms ever, with Josephine, Kyle, Laura, and Marco having come and gone in the last few weeks. What may be the highest temperature ever recorded on Earth was recorded in California at 130 degrees. California wildfires have burned well over 1 million acres of forest. Canada's last intact ice shelf, larger than Manhattan, just collapsed. Also, new research showing that air pollution that accompanies climate change is much more deadly in itself, forgetting about climate change, than was previously known. A new study came out showing that Greenland's ice sheet has melted to a point of no return, and efforts to slow global warming will not stop it from disintegrating. And those are just some of the big climate stories of late. In the past 6 months, we've done shows that have focused on some of the extraordinary issues of the day, from the causes of COVID-19 and most of the other pandemics to impact our globe in the past 100 plus years, to how to make yourself much less likely to suffer from the worst consequences of COVID-19 via dietary practices that can actually enable you to prevent and reverse preconditions that make us more vulnerable to the worst outcomes from this virus. And we talked to Lauren Ornelas from the Food Empowerments Project about the very real oppression that exists in our food production system, as well as the topic of environmental racism. On this evening's show, I'd like to stray a bit off of our usual map and talk a bit about something that I don't know a lot about. How about that? But which is a force in our world, and it is the background of almost every conversation when you're not talking about COVID or the election, and that is racism. While I'm now learning about the ways racism expresses itself in our society, and I'll talk about that shortly, one thing I do know is that there is a pattern in dealing with all the issues I've mentioned that is the same old way of being that we've witnessed in some of our public officials since I've been doing nonprofit work. And that's a long time. That pattern is to ignore social, environmental, and health issues until they're blowing up into emergencies that can't be ignored any longer. And despite the fact that doing so is dangerous and short-sighted, in many cases, this pattern has become standard operating procedure. And it's hard to understand why. I'm going to read you a little story, and it's from a book called Reclaiming Our Health. John Robbins wrote this book. It goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a large and rich country where people kept falling over a steep cliff. They'd fall to the bottom and be injured, sometimes quite seriously, and many of them died. The nation's medical establishments responded to the situation by positioning at the base of the cliff the most sophisticated and expensive ambulance fleet ever developed, which would immediately rush those who had fallen to modern hospitals that were equipped with the latest technological wizardry. No expense was too great, they said, when people's health was at stake. Now it happens that it occurred to certain people that another possibility would be to erect a fence at the top of the cliff. When they voiced the idea, however, they found themselves ignored. The ambulance drivers were not particularly keen on the idea, nor were the people who manufactured the ambulances, nor those who made their living and enjoyed prestige in the hospital industry. The medical authorities explained patiently that the problem was far more complex than people realized, that while building a fence might seem like an interesting idea, it was actually far from practical, and that health was too important to be left in the hands of people who were not experts. "Leave it to us," they said, "for with enough money, we will soon be able to genetically engineer people who do not bruise or become injured from such falls." So no fences were built, and as time passed, this nation found itself spending an ever-increasing amount of its financial resources on hospitals and high-tech medical equipment. In fact, it came to spend far more money on medical services than any nation had ever done in the history of the world. Money that could have gone to community services, decent housing, education, and good food was not available to the people, for it was being spent on ambulances and hospitals. As the costs of treating people kept rising, growing numbers of people could not afford medical care. There were increasing numbers of homeless, and even more hungry people and families torn apart by stress. As a result of these and similar misallocations of national energy and resources, violence, gangs, and inner-city riots welled up as outlets for the frustration and despair people felt. The more people kept falling off the cliff, the more a sense of urgency and tension developed, and the more of the country's money was poured into the heroic search for a drug that could be given to those who had fallen to cure their injuries. When some people pointed out how fruitless the search had been thus far and questioned whether a cure would ever be found, the research industry answered with massive public relations campaigns showing men in white coats holding the broken bodies of children who had fallen, pleading, "Don't quit on us now. We're almost there." Of course, this is just a fable. Well, basically, the point of that fable was that as a society, we are focusing our resources and attention on fixing the symptoms of health problems, when all the while, the source of these health issues is now well understood, and therefore these diseases are largely preventable. This has been the thrust of our nonprofit, Healthy Planet, and our work over the years, and that is that if we address the causes of the challenges that we're facing, health and environmental and social, as they arise, we'll fare much better than if we wait to address the end results. In our personal lives, we've all experienced that tendency to ignore problems that arise. Even though when we do that, we can end up spending a whole lot more time, energy, and money handling the ensuing and expected crisis. Think about a roof leak that you have that starts out as a drip. You see it in your attic one day, and you notice it the next year, and it's just a little bit more of a drip. And you wait, 5 years pass, and then the drip becomes too fast and you have to fix it. Well, at first, that leak may have just taken a bit of roofing cement, maybe a changed tile, maybe a bead of caulk. But after 5-10 years, you're now looking at pulling off the roofing shingles because the sheathing underneath the shingles is all rotten. And then you have to perhaps remove the roof rafter because that too is rotted out from the water. Just one bead of caulk, one dab of roofing cement. And we're now living in a world where we're paying the price of ignoring the causes of issues across the board, and today we're being forced to deal with the mess. Despite climate scientists warning us of extreme storms, wildfires, and droughts, rising sea levels and more, now, as I mentioned, in California, those predicted wildfires have caused the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people. To make matters worse, at a time when the health of our lungs is critical for dealing with COVID-19, millions of people of all ages are forced to breathe the smoke from those fires. The coronavirus itself, as we've discussed many times here, was, of course, not an unpredicted event, but the result of an ongoing, relentless incursion into nature and of a society that's so attached to raising, confining, and killing animals for food and other purposes that we ignore the warnings that such diseases are not only possible, but likely going forward. and future viruses that come from the destruction of nature and from eating animals can make COVID-19 look like the common cold. We've had over 100 years of warnings. Just look at the bird flu pandemic of 1918, SARS, the other bird flus recently, swine flu, the seasonal flu, HIV, MERS, and more, all zoonotic diseases. That is, they originated with the animals that we refuse to leave alone. The result is hundreds of thousands and over 1 million dead. And instead of building that fence to stop people from falling off the cliff, we're rushing to research and we're sending ambulances to help the victims after they've fallen. And things seem to be getting much more wild month by month. In the Gulf Coast just last week, a tropical storm was followed 2 days later by Hurricane Laura and the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people. It looks like this year could be another record-breaking year in terms of global temperatures. And of course, as we've discussed many times, the last 5 years are the warmest 5 years in recorded history, as are the last 10 years. And the 19 hottest years on record have all occurred in the last 20 years. Even with these really clear warnings, and with climate scientists telling us that we need to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change by taking on drastic cuts now in our use of fossil fuels and our use of animal products for food, despite that, our current government is pushing for more use of the dirtiest fossil fuels. In fact, in the last 2 weeks, the Trump administration said it officially approved a plan to open a pristine Arctic wildlife refuge in Alaska for oil drilling. That's 1.5 million acres of the National Wildlife Refuge. It's really sad. There's no sane explanation for such short-sighted policy other than perceived political gains and short-term profit at the expense of future generations, of course. Now, the old guys who are pushing this policy, will likely be insulated from the damage this causes to this and future generations, since they've got the means to protect themselves. God only knows how they justify this damage to their kids and grandkids. On the other hand, the most vulnerable populations, the poorest in the world, will be fighting for their very survival. As glaciers dry up, drinking water for billions becomes scarce, sea levels rise, and extreme weather becomes the norm, leaving them no place to go. And by the way, yes, glaciers are drying up. In fact, between 1980 and 2018, glaciers tracked by the World Glacier Monitoring Service have lost ice equivalent to 21.7 meters of liquid water. That's the equivalent of cutting a 79-foot-thick slice off the top of each glacier. That's especially frightening when you consider that about 3/4 of the Earth's fresh water is stored in glaciers, and billions of people rely upon melting glacial water for their water supply and to grow their food. Climate change is indeed an example of how addressing the causes of a problem are so much more effective than either ignoring it or focusing on expensive fixes, like clean coal, for example, or mitigation. Let's put 10-foot walls around all of our cities on all the coasts 20 years from now. Let's spend trillions and trillions of dollars on climate change. That's what's expected. On the other hand, addressing the causes of climate change strikes at the heart of the issue. We can do that by reducing our consumption of dirty energy via energy efficiency measures, cutting back on animal products in our diet, investing in clean energy technologies, stopping the investment in dirty energy technologies, and that's just to name some of the big achievable solutions. These solutions are here today. They're cost-effective today, and they don't require further technological advances. They also bring along with them benefits that make them no-brainers for a whole lot of other reasons. And I love no-brainers. Win-win solutions. And while this is not the topic of the show, I will mention that by addressing these solutions, we'll put many more people to work, as clean energy and energy efficiency create many more jobs than the burning of fossil fuels for power. Anyone who's heard this show has that sentence ringing in their minds. And for anybody who has listened to this show over the years, you know that moving to clean energy will also save some of the hundreds of thousands of lives lost each year in the U.S. as a result of air pollution. We've been hammering that fact over and over again. Plenty of guests and discussions since we're talking about a huge avoidable loss of life. But our government, as I mentioned, persists in pushing the cause of pollution and dirty energy. Even if you don't believe in climate change, and no, it's not a matter of belief, but even if you don't believe it because you've been listening to the wrong people, you ought to be just as enthusiastic about encouraging our elected officials on both sides of the aisle to reduce climate change pollution. And by the way, by addressing air pollution, a humanitarian nightmare of extreme proportions that disproportionately impacts people of color, will be massively benefiting our economy. Just this month on that topic, the latest in-depth air quality research that I will note is currently going through peer review revealed that the effects of air pollution are roughly twice as bad as previously estimated, and it was already bad, and how taking action now would be much more cost-effective than waiting. The research showed, and I quote, "The air quality co-benefits are generally so valuable that they exceed the cost of climate action, often many times over. Over the next 50 years, keeping to the 2-degree centigrade pathway would prevent roughly 4.5 million premature deaths, about 3.5 million hospitalizations and emergency room visits, and approximately 300 million lost workdays in the United States. All that prevented death, illness, and lost productivity adds up to a lot of economic savings. The avoided deaths are valued at more than $37 trillion. The avoided healthcare spending due to reduced hospitalizations and emergency room visits exceeds $37 billion. And the increased labor productivity is valued at more than $75 billion. On average, this amounts to over $700 billion per year in benefits to the United States from improved health and labor alone, far more than the cost of any planned clean energy transition. So we now have this new cost-benefit analysis that basically says that it's a no-brainer on all levels to take rapid and comprehensive action on air pollution and, in turn, climate change. But will this spur action on the part of our elected officials? Well, that depends on who we elect. And that depends on how vocal we are in letting them know that this is an issue that we care deeply about. And of course, the original example of the folly of focusing on the symptoms of the problem versus the causes is visible when examining public health. When I was growing up, we generally thought that the diseases that were killing most of us were acts of God. Now we know that most of them, that's right, most heart disease, diabetes, other chronic degenerative diseases, and even cancer, are indeed often preventable, and in many cases reversible, via diet modification and lifestyle modification. So our governments can do a massive education campaign that lets the public know that a whole foods plant-based diet can make you, to quote Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who's been on this show, virtually heart attack proof. Or they can ignore the problem and have the country keep eating the way everybody else does and end up with so many of us dying prematurely from almost entirely avoidable diseases. Getting back to the issue of racism, it's similar to these other issues I've just talked about. It's a problem that exists that has been demanding our attention, but that we've been doing our best to ignore, and in some cases, some people, to incite. And while we've been ignoring it, the awareness nonetheless has been gaining energy. And that energy is now manifest in the global protests that we've seen over the past several months. And just a footnote here. For those of you, when you hear about the protests, glaze right over the protests and the reason for the protests, and you say, oh, the looting and the burning and the loss of property. I understand why you think that. I understand why you go there. But don't gloss over the causative issue. Nobody condones the looting. Nobody condones the violence. Nobody condones the burning. That's happening. We've got to stop it. But the underlying issue remains as important as it would be, even if every one of these protests was peaceful, and the vast majority of them are, despite what you're seeing on the news that focuses on one aspect of this issue to create misunderstanding. While some still deny it, it's pretty clear that being a person of color in America brings with it challenges that many white people simply can't relate to or understand, which is why many still deny it even exists. Until the recent police killings of unarmed black people and the ensuing protests, I myself had limited grasp about specifically how that difference in experience between being a black man and a white man, in my case, was manifesting in society. So over the last few months, I've been listening and learning and talking about the specifics so I could understand what I see as a truly inspiring moment in history, a moment where people of all colors, ages, and genders are standing up for the concept that a black life matters as much as anybody else's life. And in my online journey to educate myself on these issues, I found a whole lot of resources that have been really helpful in allowing me to more deeply understand how systemic racism operates. I knew it existed before. I fully understood that racism was a power and a force in our society, and that the flames of racism were being stoked by various political people. But it's good to also understand the specifics and to see how it's operating in people's day-to-day lives. Before I share some of those with you, I'll say a few words about systemic racism. Let's get our terms right. What are we talking about here? The Aspen Institute states that structural racism is not something that a few people or institutions choose to practice. Instead, it's been a part of the social, economic, and political systems in which we exist. It is part of America's past and its present. One definition of structural racism in the U.S. is the normalization and legitimization of an array of dynamics, historical, cultural, institutional, and interpersonal, that routinely advantage whites while producing cumulative and chronic adverse outcomes for people of color. So if hearing that makes you still say, well, what are those dynamics that routinely disadvantage people of color and advantage white people? Do those things really exist? How are they playing out in society? I'm going to play a few very brief messages on these manifestations of systemic racism. These were created and put out by a group called Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation. This first one is on the wealth gap.
Oh, hey, I didn't see you there. So if you're like most Americans, you probably say to yourself all the time, systemic racism, is that really a thing? Did you know that in 2010, black Americans made up 13% of the population, but only had 2.7% of the country's wealth? That the median net worth for a white family was $134,000, but the median net worth for a Hispanic family was $14,000, and for black Americans it was $11,000? You know that the median wealth for a single white woman has been measured at $41,000, but for a Hispanic woman it was $140? And for a black woman, $120? Did you know that? Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
I've been aware of the wealth gap and the ever-increasing wealth gap in America over the past several decades, but I had no idea that the median net worth for a white family was $134,000. And the median net worth for a black family was $11,000. That's just hard to grasp. This next one is on employment.
Well, did you know that year in and year out for the last 60 years, no matter what else is going on in America, black unemployment has been about twice white unemployment? That even if you just look at black college graduates, their unemployment rate is always twice that of white college graduates? And even if all you do is apply for a job with a white-sounding name, you're 50% more likely to get a callback than if you have a black-sounding name? Did you know that? Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
Now, you could think when you're talking about employment that, well, certain candidates are more employable than others. They have better skills. They have better education. They have more experience, etc., etc. But Business Insider reported that there was a Harvard University study that found when blacks and Asians whitens their resumes. For example, they used American or white-sounding names. They got more callbacks for corporate interviews. 25% of black candidates received callbacks from their whitened resumes, while only 10% got calls back when they left ethnic details on their resume. That's a big swing. In addition, many companies rely on employee social networks for referrals, which can be problematic if your company is largely white. Diversity experts told Business Insider that one survey found that 3/4 of white employees don't have any non-white friends. So if they don't have any non-white friends and companies rely upon employee social networks for referrals, it pretty much closes the door to those people who are not white. And that could partly explain why, as of 2020, only 4 Fortune 500 companies have black CEOs. In 2018, the average black worker earns just 62% of what the average white worker made. Similarly, overall income for black Americans was about 42% lower than for whites in 2018. Lower incomes mean that the poverty rates for black families are over twice that of white families. And understanding this about employment can give you a little bit of insight about how the system itself is setting the stage for this income disparity. Let's listen now to a message about housing discrimination.
You know, if you're like most Americans, you probably say to yourself all the time, systemic racism, is that really a thing? Well, what would you call it if lifetimes of legal segregation, followed by decades of pervasive racist housing policies, still, to this day, disadvantage black people in every aspect of life? Because where you live can help decide what food you eat, what sort of jobs you can get, how safe you are, what sort of health care you can get, and the quality of your children's education. Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
And here's another one on systemic racism and incarceration.
Systemic racism, is that really a thing? Well, did you know that back in the 1980s, there were less than 500,000 people in the U.S. prison system, but now, thanks to the war on drugs, there are more than 2 million? Did you know that out of every 100,000 Americans, about 700 are incarcerated, but out of every 100,000 black men, over 4,000 are incarcerated? And that one of the many effects of that trend is, combined with felony disenfranchisement laws, it means that 13% of black American men are denied the right to vote. Did you know that? Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
And here's a message on systemic racism and drug arrests.
Well, did you know that out of all drug arrests in America, 40% are not for selling any kind of drugs, but just for possessing marijuana? And that white and black Americans use marijuana at the same rates, but black Americans are 3.7 times more likely to get arrested for it? Did you know that? Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
And here's one about immigration. Of course, a very hot topic over the last 4 years.
Systemic racism, is that really a thing? Well, have you ever wondered why, even though undocumented people come to the United States from all over the world, the face of undocumented people is always assumed to be Central American or South American? And why our heavy-handed immigration policies that tear lives apart and ruin families every day are focused almost entirely on the southern U.S. border and the Hispanic people of color that come across that border? Have you ever wondered why that is? Well, that's because of systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
And here's one more on infant mortality and systemic racism.
Systemic racism? Is that really a thing? Well, did you know that even though America's infant mortality rates have gone way down in the last 50 years, black babies are still about 2.5 times more likely to die before reaching their first birthday? Did you know that black mothers are 3 times more likely to die during childbirth? That black and Hispanic women are more than twice as likely not to receive proper prenatal care, and Native American mothers are 3 times less likely to receive proper care? Did you know that? Do you know what that's called? That's called systemic racism. And yes, it's really a thing.
And you're listening to Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program as part of Natural Alternatives. And we're on 90.1 FM WUSB, Stony Brook. We've been listening to a series of short messages from a group called Race Forward, the Center for Racial Justice Innovation. And you can find more about them at www.raceforward.org. And speaking of that last topic, which was infant mortality, let's expand that to access to quality healthcare in the Black community. We've all heard how people of color are more vulnerable to COVID-19. And that's not because they're inherently more susceptible to the virus. They do have higher rates of the lifestyle-related preconditions that make one more likely to suffer from the worst impacts of COVID-19. But part of that is the result of systemic racism, as they're more likely to live in communities where healthful food options are simply not available. Additionally, because people of color are more likely to live by major roads polluting industries, they're more exposed to air pollution, which also makes you more vulnerable to the worst effects of COVID-19. Add to that that people of color have gone through decades of unequal access to healthcare. Finally, Black people make up a disproportionate percentage of jail populations, and public health experts have warned that inmates face severe risk of not being able to escape exposure to the virus. So even COVID-19 risks are impacted by environmental racism. So on that note, let's say a few more words about environmental racism. Lauren Ornelas, who joined us on the show a couple of months ago, pointed out that environmental racism is apparent in ways that we may likely have not ever noticed, unless we were a person of color. For instance, in Black, Brown, or Indigenous communities, there are more truck depots, toxic waste facilities, factory farms, power plants, waste facilities, etc. Environmental racism is when these people of color are exposed to more environmental burdens than white and more wealthy communities. Those who live near factory farms and dairy farms suffer more nosebleeds, headaches, asthma, horrible, ever-present odors. Who lives near the farms that use all the dangerous chemicals that are used to grow our non-organic foods? Well, it's not those of us in mansions. It's not those of us who have the means to not live in those neighborhoods. It's disproportionately Black, Brown, and Indigenous people who live in places that we would not care to live. That, in and of itself, is unjust. What's equally unjust is that the people who are unable to avoid living in the shadow of polluting industries are not the people with any kind of political power. So they don't make the rules. They don't make the big political donations. They don't have the connections. So when privileged legislators, most of whom are white men, are deciding between clean or dirty industries, fossil fuels or clean energy, it's with the understanding that these polluting industries will not be located in the neighborhood or the neighborhoods of their families or campaign contributors. They're also insulated from the impacts of their short-sighted, life-threatening decisions. So this environmental injustice is able to be self-propagating, since there are no checks on it from the people who are adversely impacted. And since this latest historic movement, with millions of people protesting around the world, people of all colors, races, ages, and socioeconomic status, was motivated by police violence, let's talk a bit about that. Statistics show that while more white Americans are killed by the police, overall, people of color are killed at higher rates. A federal study that examines lethal force used by the police from 2009 to 2012 found that a majority of the victims were white, but the victims were disproportionately Black. Black people had a fatality rate at the hands of police officers that was 2.8 times as high as that of white people. Also, of people killed by police officers, Black people are more likely to be unarmed compared to white people. Here's something else that's interesting. The levels of violent crime in U.S. cities do not determine rates of police violence. So it's not the case, as you might intuitively think, that a city with a high crime rate has more police violence. This can be seen when comparing various cities. In this case, we're talking about Buffalo and Orlando, Florida. Similar populations, crime rates, percentages of people of color. In Buffalo, they have 258,000, Orlando, 255,000. The percentage people of color in Buffalo is 50%. percentage people of color in Orlando, 42%. The violent crime rate in Buffalo is 12 per 1,000. And the violence crime rate in Orlando is 9 per 1,000. The people killed by Buffalo police from 2013 to 2016 was zero. And yet 13 people during that same time were killed by Orlando police. So there's something else at play here that would explain that disparity. It's also interesting to note that those places where there were more killings were often explained by the police fearful of the victim holding a gun. And the communities where they're more afraid of victims holding guns is where they have more lax gun laws. So the point of me speaking about police violence overall is not to say that all police are violent, all police are bad, and I don't think anybody believes that. The point of discussing police violence is to say that any police violence that is perpetrated by someone who is racist, who does it for racist purposes, whether known or unknown to themselves, should not be on the police force. There needs to be a more careful screening process, and there needs to be more of an inquiry into violence committed by police in the line of duty. According to Mapping Police Violence, that used crime data from 2013 to 2018, the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, 47% of unarmed people killed by the 100 largest city police departments were black, 47%. These police departments killed unarmed black people at a rate four times higher than unarmed white people. Are police shootings of blacks always the result of a racist police officer? Probably not. However, no doubt, sometimes they are, because racism is prevalent in our society. The Deputy Executive Director of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Terrence Cunningham, stated it this way, and I quote, "There are racist journalists, racist doctors, there are racist lawyers, but because the police are the most visible arm of the government, and because they are empowered to use force, including deadly force, and they have the power to take people's rights away and arrest them, that's why it's more important than in any other profession that you get this right." This director of the International Association of Chiefs of Police also said that those police officers who are racist or have racial bias need to be trained, and if that doesn't fix it, that they should be fired. And those words from someone in law enforcement are something I hope that we can all get behind, regardless of our political stance on other issues. Racist attitudes and practices go back hundreds of years in the United States and, of course, have been a part of our civilization's history forever. We've been talking about how ignoring problems and addressing them only when they become emergencies is neither effective nor wise. About 4 years ago, Colin Kaepernick took up the cause of saying something about systemic racism. Like other black athletes in history, he used his position as a sports figure to take that stand. A couple of days ago, I was talking to someone who is decidedly conservative, and it was their opinion that Kaepernick was just grandstanding, trying to make a name for himself, disrespecting the flag, and disrespecting those who have fought for this country. And when I told him that, from what I had seen, Kaepernick, agree with him or not on the issue, was taking the action he did from a deeply principled place. I told him that he took that action knowing full well that he was risking his career to speak out for those who didn't have the voice or the platform. I told him how inspiring I found it that professional athletes from entire MLB teams to NBA teams and even a professional tennis player were now themselves speaking out and taking action for the same cause that Colin Kaepernick championed 4 years ago. I told him that the NFL apologized for not taking the issue of systemic racism seriously, and that Kaepernick's actions had rightly earned him awards since that time. His response was that these other athletes were just jumping on the bandwagon, and that Kaepernick has had 4 years to modify his original motivations to make them sound good. So I went back to when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee before a regular season game. That was in 2016. I did that in order to hear his original hot off the press, justification for his actions. And I have to tell you, between that conference and the speaking he's done since that time, the message of disrespecting the flag and our troops was not there. So it made me question, why did people have that impression from his words that he was saying that? So I looked at conservative media's headlines that came out the day after that press conference. And I found this commentary. This is the headline. NFL's Kaepernick insults Americans, law enforcement officers everywhere. And I quote, Kaepernick's comments weren't just an insult to the over 1 million Americans, many thousands of whom were African American, who have given their lives in defense of the United States from wars as far back as the American Revolution to the more recent conflicts in the Middle East. I continued reading this conservative commentary. Kaepernick also turned his back on the thousands of police officers, again, a tremendous number of whom were African American, who have died defending their communities and upholding the rule of law. End quote. Now, what I see when I read this is a created reality that bears little resemblance to what actually happened, to what actually came out of Colin Kaepernick's mouth, and to the intent of Colin Kaepernick. It's really horrible to see this. And then for years after, I heard the same narrative over and over again, disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the troops, when he said many times that he's not disrespecting the flag. He's not disrespecting the troops. So on that note, instead of you listening to me and believing me, and instead of you listening to the interpretation of conservative media, I'm going to play as much of Colin Kaepernick's original press conference as we can fit in. And this again happens right after the first game, when he took a knee in order to speak for those people who do not have a voice and who he is talking about as having a day-to-day experience of injustice at the hands of society. Here you go.
What are you trying to accomplish? What would you like this, you know, to be the end game for you?
That's basically... I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people, you know, realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Is this something that's evolved as a philosophy in your mind? And how has this kind of progressed that you make a stand like this?
It's something that I've seen, I've felt, wasn't quite sure how to deal with originally, and it is something that's evolved. It's something as I've gained more knowledge about, you know, what's going on in this country in the past, what's going on currently. These aren't new situations. This isn't new ground. It's things that have gone on in this country for years and years and have never been addressed, and they need to be.
Will you continue, Colin, to sit?
Yes, I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
Specifically, what would you like to see change in order for you to stand?
There's a lot of things that need to change. One specifically is police brutality. There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. That's not right by anyone's standards.
Colin, so many people see the flag as kind of a symbol of military. How do you view it, and what do you say to those people?
You know, I have great respect for men and women that have fought for this country. I have family, I have friends that have gone and fought for this country. And they fight for freedom. They fight for the people, they fight for liberty and justice for everyone. And that's not happening. I mean, people are dying in vain because this country isn't holding their end of the bargain up as far as, you know, giving freedom and justice and liberty to everybody. It's something that's not happening. And I've seen videos, I've seen circumstances where men and women that have been in the military have come back and been treated unjustly by the country they fought for and have been murdered by the country they fought for on our land. That's not right.
Colin, do you personally feel oppressed? Personally?
There have been situations where I feel like I've been ill-treated, yes, but this stand wasn't for me. This stand wasn't because I feel like I'm being put down in any kind of way. This is because I'm seeing things happen to people that don't have a voice, people that don't have a platform to talk and have their voices heard and affect change. So I'm in a position where I can do that, and I'm gonna do that for people that can't.
Is this the first year that you haven't stood up? Did you do it other years, or is this the first time?
This year's the first year that I've done this.
You did all the preseason games so far?
Yes.
This is the first time it was noticed?
Yes.
How did your teammates respond when you explained yourself today, and what was the support like for you?
The support I've got from my teammates has been great. You know, I think a lot of my teammates come from areas where this might be a situation. Their families might be put in this situation. It's something that I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, I really respect you for what you're doing and what you're standing for. So to me, that's something that I know what I'm doing what's right, and I know other people see what I'm doing is right. It's something that we have to come together, we have to unite, we have to unify and make a change.
What do you say to the people that say, hey, you're doing the right thing, but you're going about it the wrong way?
I don't understand how it's the wrong way. To me, this is a freedom that we're allowed in this country. And going back to the military thing, it's a freedom that men and women that have fought for this country have given me this opportunity by the contributions they have made. So I don't see it as going about it the wrong way. This is something that has to be said. It has to be brought to the forefront of everyone's attention. And when that's done, I think people can realize what the situation is and then really affect change.
You've done it every preseason game. Are you almost relieved that it took this game and the questioning that followed to let your voice be heard?
It wasn't something that I really planned as far as it blowing up. It was something that I personally decided I just can't stand for what this represents right now. It's not right. And the fact that it has blown up like this, I think is a good thing. You know, it brings awareness. Everybody knows what's going on, and this sheds more light on it. Now I think people are really talking about it, having conversations about how to make change, what's really going on in this country, and we can move forward.
Are you concerned that it's seen as like a blanket indictment of law enforcement in general?
What was that?
Are you concerned that it can be seen as a blanket indictment against law enforcement in general?
As far as what? I don't really understand what you're trying to get at.
People getting murdered by police. I mean, do you think that it seems as sort of an indictment against police?
There is police brutality.
Yeah.
People of color have been targeted by police. Mm-hmm. So that's a large part of it. And they're government officials. They're put in place by the government. So, you know, that's something that this country has to change. Mm-hmm. There's things we can do to, you know, hold them more accountable, make those standards higher. You have people that practice law and are lawyers and go to school for 8 years, but you can become a cop in 6 months and don't have to have the same amount of training as a cosmetologist. That's insane. I mean, someone that's holding a curling iron has more education and more training than people that have a gun and are going out on the street to protect us.
Colin, you said doing stuff beyond sitting.
What was that?
Do you plan on doing stuff beyond sitting during the national anthem, as far as activists kind of, you know, rolling your sleeves up and getting out in the communities?
Yeah, most definitely. There are things I have in the works right now that I'm working on to, you know, put together in the future and come to fruition soon. Those are things that I'll talk about as we get closer to those days.
Colin, you say that this is it's a good thing that this is blowing up now because it's getting some attention. Any concern about the timing of it, a critical part of training camp, and the possibility of it being a distraction?
No, I don't see it as a distraction. I think it's something that can unify this team, is something that can unify this country. You know, if we have these real conversations that are uncomfortable for a lot of people, if we have these conversations, there's a better understanding where both sides are coming from. And if we reach common ground and can understand what everybody's going through, we can really affect change and make sure that everybody's treated equally and has the same freedom.
Cap, has anybody from the league or the team or anybody said, tone it down or anything? Because clearly you're speaking your mind by now. It doesn't seem that anyone's trying to, from the organization, whatever, is trying to quiet you.
No, no one's tried to quiet me, and no, to be honest, it's not something I'm going to be quiet about. I'm going to speak the truth when I'm asked about it. It's not, this isn't for a look, this isn't for publicity or anything like that. This is for people that don't have the voice. And this is for people that are being oppressed and need to have equal opportunities, you know, to be successful, to provide for their families and not live in poor circumstances.
Have you been pulled over unjustly that on court, you know, in your mind, have you been pulled over unjustly or had a bad experience in that regard?
Yes, multiple times. I mean, I've had times where one of my roommates was moving out of a house in college, and because we were the only black people in that neighborhood, the cops got called and all of us had guns drawn on us. I mean, came in the house without knocking, guns drawn on one of my teammates and roommates. So I have experienced this. People close to me have experienced this. This isn't something that's a one-off case here, a one-off case there. This has become habitual. It's become a habit. So it's something that needs to be addressed.
One of 2,000 players in the NFL. You're a lone voice here as far as taking this stand. Why do you think you're the only one doing this?
I think there's a lot of consequences that come along with this. There's a lot of people that don't want to have this conversation, that, you know, they're scared they might lose their job or they might not get the endorsements. They might not be treated the same way. And those are things I'm prepared to handle, and those are things that, you know, other people might not be ready for. It's just a matter of where you're at in your life, where your mind's at. And at this point, I've been blessed to be able to get this far and, you know, have the privilege of being in the NFL and, you know, making the kind of money I make and enjoy luxuries like that. But I can't look in the mirror and see other people dying on the street that should have the same opportunities that I've had and say, you know what, I can live with myself, because I can't if I just watch.
Do you think you might get cut over this?
I don't know. But if I do, I know I did what's right, and I can live with that at the end of the day.
Does any of this reflect your relationship with the 49ers or with the NFL? Is this any part of that?
No, this is about the way people have been treated by this country.
When you addressed the team today, Colin, how long did you talk, and what was kind of the tone of it? It seemed like you were able to convert one person into your line of thinking that was a little skeptical.
No, it was a conversation. They asked me to talk and just explain why I did what I did and why I felt the way I felt. And that's I had an open conversation with them. I told them why I felt that way and why I looked at things the way I do. And a lot of it has to do with the history of the country and where we're currently at. And, you know, I opened it up to all my teammates. Come talk to me if you have any questions. If you want to understand what I'm thinking further, come talk to me. This isn't something that should be hidden and shouldn't be talked about. These conversations need to happen, and I think it's something that can bring everybody closer.
Were there a couple guys that voiced how they felt against what you're doing to you?
There were, you know, I've had people say, no, I want to understand further, let's talk. So I've had those conversations, and we'll continue to have them with my teammates. But it's something that the knowledge of what's happened in this country and is currently happening is something that I think everybody needs to know. And when you have the knowledge of those things, then you can make an educated decision on, you know, what you really feel and what you want to stand for.
Has any of this been a distraction?
In terms of politicians or, you know, people outside the sports world to tell you that they support you through this?
I've had a few people reach out. Quite a few, actually, saying, you know, we really support you. We're proud of you for taking that stand. We respect what you're doing. We know a lot's going to come with it, but we're behind you. And, you know, that means a lot. That means that I'm not the only one that feels this way, and I'm not the only one that sees things this way.
In that same vein, did you reach out to anyone before you did this to seek their counsel, say, hey, what do you think about this at all?
This is a conversation I've had with a lot of people a lot of times over a long period of time. So it wasn't something that, you know, I planned on having a conversation about at a particular time. It just so happened it was the other night that people realized it and talked about it. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's all
right. It makes you want to bring a voice to other people. You want to raise consciousness about certain issues. Are you concerned? So much of the talk with the 24 hours has been about you and not necessarily the issues. Are you concerned that could happen?
I do think that, you know, the talk has been more about me, more about, I know a lot of people's initial reactions thought it was bashing the military, which it wasn't. That wasn't my intention at all. I think now that we have those things cleared up, we can get to the root of what I was saying and really address those issues.
Since you've done this, other, you know, of other players who feel the same way but maybe not ready to step forward publicly?
What was your question?
Do you know other players who are kind of feel the same way that you do but are afraid to really step forward publicly like you have?
Yeah, I know there's other players that feel the same way. I've had players reach out to me. You know, once again, it's not something I'm going to ask them to put their necks out. I know the consequences that come along with my decision, and if they feel strongly about it and want to stand with me, then I hope they do. If it's something they're not ready for, you know, that's what the conversations are for, and they can make that decision, you know, when they're ready or if they're ready.
Do you feel you'll be safe? Do you feel you'll be safe in some of the road cities that you go to, and will you take some precautions? I mean, that's an illegitimate thought.
Not really too concerned about that. No, at the end of the day, if something happens, that's only proving my point. Yeah, that's...
Dr. Edwards has some experience with public stances such as this. You were talking to him before practice. Is he someone you consulted with at any point on the right when you decided to do this?
I mean, once again, it wasn't something I consulted anybody on. It was a conversation I had when someone asked me about it. Dr. Edwards is a good friend. He's someone I talk to a lot and run a lot of things by and have a lot of conversations with. And we have a lot of similar views.
Colin, the fact that this is an election year, does this have anything to do with the timing?
I mean, once again, it wasn't a timing thing. It wasn't something that was planned. But I think the two presidential candidates that we currently have also represent the issue that we have in this country right now.
You want to expound on that?
I mean, you have Hillary, who's called black teens or black kids super predators. You have Donald Trump, who's openly racist.
And that's all we have time for today. So what's your take? Did it sound like he was out there just to disrespect the flag? Or did you hear the fact that he was acting out of principle and taking a risk? And by the way, since that time, 4 years later, he's been vindicated. The rest of the world has come around to see that what he was saying back then and what he paid the price for saying back then was actually reflective of a deep problem that was continuing in America. And that's all we have time for this evening. My name is Bob DiBenedetto. I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again next week, Friday, September 11th, at this same time. That's right, at 6 p.m., For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group on health and environmental issues, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, keep moving even at home, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share. Good night.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience, but every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.